this is the 11th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist living in Southwest Florida. I'm also an endurance athlete. I've run several marathons and completed two Ironmans. The podcast is mainly about plant-based wellness, vegan lifestyle, and how it helps my endurance athletic endeavors. I try to interview people that are endurance athletes as well as nutritionists, combination of the both. I like to talk to people about their plant-based journeys, and hopefully we'll answer questions to people thinking about becoming plant-based, help people go plant-based, and even bring the two camps of vegan and plant-based together. It's my belief that plant-based people ultimately will become more ethical and have more compassion for animals and the environment. I also believe that there's room for ethical vegans to become more healthy and maybe better stewards for the plant-based movement so that we can get more people involved. During a recent lecture, I cited a study from the Humane Research Council on the number of vegans and vegetarians in the United States. It was analysis of over 11,000 people with a detailed questionnaire. They studied the population in the United States of 17 and older age groups. They found that 2% were current vegans or vegetarians, 10% were former vegans or vegetarians, and 88% had never been vegan or vegetarian. And that's the sad statistic revealed that there were 24 million former vegetarians or vegans and fewer than 5 million current vegans or vegetarians. Of those studied, the mean age was 48 years of age that were former vegetarians. 44% of those were over 50. 69% were women. Most people gave the reason for reverting back to eating animal products was that they transitioned too quickly and couldn't maintain it. Health was a major motivator for becoming vegan. 58% said vegans and vegetarians said they did it for health reasons, 20% for animals. If people were going to remain vegan, a majority of them felt that they were had multiple reasons. For people that weren't vegan or vegetarians anymore, 37% of those said they would like to try again. And that corresponds to 4% of the population. So that statistic is helpful, or hopeful, I should say, that there's a lot of people that would like to become vegan, but maybe just don't know how to make the transition and need a little help and support. 67% of the people that reverted back to eating meat said they didn't want to stick out in the crowd and it wasn't their identity. So I think that, you know, there's room to soften the identity of being plant-based and maybe not so hardcore as far as the factory farming and all the kind of gory pictures. But I also think that we need to realize where our food comes from and to be compassionate and not be afraid to be compassionate. Also to realize just what an impact eating animals have on the environment and the water supply. So, you know, there's like the more education that's out there, I think the better. The more plant-based choices, the better. So we'll continue to try to educate people to become vegan and plant-based. Tonight's lecture is with Dr. Ruth Heydrich. She's a very dynamic professor. She was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 48 after being what she thought was a healthy marathon runner. With the encouragement of Dr. McDougall and some of his early studies on the treatment of cancer with a plant-based vegan diet, she became plant-based and nearly raw and is still into her 70s. She's very active doing triathlons. She has written several books, including Lifelong Running, as well as Senior Fitness and Race for Life. She has also written a cookbook, Chef, C-H-E-F, for Cheap, Healthy, Easy, and Fast. They're all excellent books. I highly recommend them. So I hope you enjoy listening to our conversation, and I'll catch up with you after the interview. Well, I am so honored to be able to speak with Dr. Ruth Heydrich today. She is the author of many books, as I've listed before. And Dr. Heydrich, you know, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. Tell me a little bit how you got started in all this.
Oh, it was a real wake-up call. Going back to 1968, do you remember a book by Kenneth Cooper called Aerobics?
I do, actually. And it was one of the first books. Yeah.
A land-breaking book. It was wonderful. I happened across a newsstand, saw the word aerobics, and was curious. Had never seen it before. Picked up the book, and it changed my life. I finished it in one sitting and went out, ran a mile, and was hooked. 1968, long time ago. And then kept on with the running and kept increasing the distances and got up to 14 years later when I was running marathons. I was that enthusiastic about running. In 1982, I was diagnosed with advanced breast cancer, infiltrating ductal carcinoma, stage 4. I was in a state of shock, could not believe it. Here I was, the healthiest, fittest person around, and I've got advanced breast cancer. I was in a state of shock, having just had the surgery, the excisional biopsy, when I happened to see a notice in the newspaper, wanted women with breast cancer to participate in diet research study. And this was being run by Dr. John McDougall, and I think a lot of people will recognize that name. But this was back in 82 when not many people knew of him nor of any diet connection to cancer or heart disease or anything else for that matter. Anyway, this was right after my surgery and before having been referred to the oncologist to start radiation and chemotherapy. I ran to the phone and got right through to Dr. McDougall, explained that I had just been diagnosed. He said, "Get your medical records. I need to talk to you." And that was when I was exposed to the connection, the animal studies and the epidemiological studies that pointed to a strong connection between a high-fat, high animal food diet and my breast cancer. And I'm saying, "But it's too late. I've already got it." And he said, "No, I don't think it's too late, because once you change the cause of the disease, then the body, the improved immune system, can then fight it off. And you cannot have chemo or radiation, because I want to show that the diet is enough to do it." So 2 hours later, that's how long he spent with me, I went on this whole food, plant-based, low-fat, vegan diet and found that I loved it. I thought, wow, you know, I really enjoyed it and just started feeling so much better. I kept right up with the running. In fact, a couple of days after the surgery, I was back running, carefully albeit, and then found I had so much more energy, and it was right about this time, again, 1982, when I hadn't gone back to work yet from the surgery, happened on a channel showing the ABC Wide World of Sports, the Ironman Triathlon. I was transfixed. I looked at that and thought, oh my gosh, I got to do that. It's a 2.4-mile swim, and I knew how to swim. I'm in Hawaii, remember. And then you do a 112-mile bike. This was a bike race around the island. Well, I'll dig out my old bike and get back to training on the bike. And I've already got marathons handled. So I found out with this diet, my recovery was fast. I had more energy. Everything was a go as far as I was concerned. And So I was launched, and that was 34 years ago, and I'm still loving it and telling people, hey, you know, you got to change your diet. You got to get more exercise. It really makes a difference. So in a long nutshell, that's it.
Well, I mean, your family at the time, I'm sure that, you know, it's like when you came home and you said, well, you know, I'm not going to do this traditional chemo radiation. I'm just going to change my diet. I mean, did they go berserk? Or?
Oh, yes, totally. I was, in fact, accused of having fallen into the hands of a quack. I was told by my now ex-husband that he said I was surprised that he thought I was more intelligent than that. And furthermore, he wasn't going to eat that food. So I was essentially on my own. The only support I got was from Dr. McDougall. Even my oncologist said, oh, there's no indication whatsoever that your diet had anything to do with your getting breast cancer. I was having, with all the symptoms, I had the bone pain, the sky-high liver enzymes. So I was seeing other specialists, and they'd all tell me basically the same thing, that my diet had nothing to do with this. So I'd go right back to Dr. McDougall and said, well, the gastroenterologist said this, and he'd show me the evidence to the contrary. So I was kind of whipsawed back and forth, but Dr. McDougall was such a mainstay in showing me that he was right, and the other specialists really just said, oh, they just kind of poo-pooed the whole idea. And, you know, it's sad that to this day, so many of the medical professionals still haven't figured it out. That's why I'm so happy to talk to you, somebody who has figured it out, who's in a position to influence so many people. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. It took me a little time to figure it out as well. I first started the vegan thing. I read Diet for a New America, but I have a terrible family history for heart disease, which is somewhat why I became a cardiologist. Diabetes and heart disease, you know, run rampant in my family. And I always thought, you know, I mean, it's overweight. So if you keep your weight down and you run, you know, you'll be, you know, you can kind of dodge the bullet, so to speak. And it wasn't until really forks over knives is what, you know, end up hitting me in the head that I just said, you know, this is because I oscillated back and forth about 12 years ago. You know, after Diet for a New America, I kind of went vegan or I tried to go plant-based as much as possible because of the ethical reasons. But family, again, you know, no real support or encouragement.
No support,
But this time, you know, my mom got sick, and I sort of became the cook. So I kind of declared the house plant-based, and, you know, away we went. And, you know, she's done very well. And, you know, I feel the best I've ever felt. And I thought, well, this is how my patients, this is, you know, I have to pass this information along.
Good.
And so, you know, again, forks over knives led the way. I kind of think it's kind of interesting, you know, with Dr. Esselstyn with forks over knives, and he, you know, was a breast cancer surgeon and now, you know, treats heart patients. Dr. McDougall is probably one of the few that was brave enough to tackle cancer. You know, that's the big scary thing with, you know, we say we can reverse diabetes, and I believe you can with, you know, plant-based diet. You know, certainly blood pressure is easy enough, and you can do all these markers. And even coronary artery disease, if the chest pain goes away, then you're you know, kind of free sailing. But cancer is a little bit scary, know, and I just find him amazing that, you know, he was to take this on. And I almost, you know, I hope to get at some point get to ask Dr. Esselstyn the question. It's like, so why aren't you taking on cancer yet? I think, you know, I do think it's you know, amazing, and we're just, you know, I've had the debate with people before as far as physician, you know, physicians being, you know, we're taught to treat people that are sick, and we forget about, well, why did they actually get sick, and we kind of get lost in the forest a little bit.
It's diagnose and treat. And the methods to treat are drugs and surgery, so it's kind of a nice pat formula.
You know, I was looking at your. I've read two out of three of your books in your cookbook, and you know they're all wonderful. I've actually sent your latest book. that is lifelong running to a friend that just got diagnosed with breast cancer. And unfortunately, she's not quite got through it yet. So I'm hoping maybe the podcast and the little, you know, I keep leaning on her to look. You know, she went through the radiation, and I kind of heard that she felt like she needed to increase the protein in her diet to get more meat in recovery. And that seems to be a difficult thing to get past.
Yeah.
So here you are. So you set all these records. You've done how many Ironman?
Six
Ironmans, and yeah. Was Kona one of them?
Oh, four of them.
Four of them was Kona.
Yeah, my first one was Kona, because remember I'm in Hawaii, and we did have qualifiers in that year, half Ironman, which I'd won my age group. And then after I did the first one and placed, that qualified me for this, for the next year and the next year. And then Continental Airlines approached me. I'd gotten some publicity because of being a cancer patient doing the Ironman and being an older woman. And so Continental offered to sponsor me to do the New Zealand Ironman. And, oh, wow, this is really exciting. So I did that one, got a front page spread, a picture, and a headline, the major headline across the top of the New Zealand Herald, the only newspaper in New Zealand, by the way, said, Ruth, a woman of iron. I thought, wow. And I brought that back to the New Continental people. I laid it on their desk, and he looks up and he says, oh, don't they have an Iron Man in Japan? So I'm thinking, my God, I just finished Kona in October, and then in March I did New Zealand Iron Man, and I thought, I can't do another one so quickly. And then I told myself, shut up, he's offering you a trip to Japan free, just keep on training and do it. So that's what I did, and the same thing happened in Japan. All kinds of newspaper coverage, and it was just amazing, this launch rocket that I was on, having a ball in my 50s, thinking, I'm in a dream. This is a movie. It can't really be happening. I'm the healthiest I've ever been. I'm traveling all over the world doing Ironmans. And that's when Dr. McDougall said, you got to write a book. You got to tell women. He said, I tell them and they won't listen. Maybe they'll listen to you. And hence Race for Life, which I think is appropriate on so many different levels, because in a way we're all in a race for life. I love racing. It just spurs my competitive spirit on, and I think it does the same for a lot of other people. They want to test their limits. They want to do it in a group setting and have fun, and I want to race for the rest of my life, and it's life in that it gives me so much more energy. They're just can't say enough about it, what a great lifestyle this is.
So how many years do you have before you have to set the world record in Kona for the oldest triathlete?
Well, you know, there's one thing about aging. I know that everything we used to think was aging has turned out to be either disease or disuse, i.e. disease, diet, or disuse, lack of exercise. There is one thing about aging, and that is I'm slowing down. As much as I try, I'm slowing down. And so at one point I'm going to have to say, no, I'm too slow. Now, if you can help me in that realm.
Oh, I think by the sounds of you, I think you can do it. So maybe by the end of this, we'll have you signed up to go again. Because you know, I want you to set the record so I can break it someday, perhaps. You know,
okay.
That's the goal. I'm kind of slow. I'm kind of slow already, so I've got work to do yet. You know, that's my goal. I just started doing Iron Man last year. Was my first one. I did my second one this year, so I'm just now getting that. I started with the marathons, and I've just kind of crossed over after friends say, "Oh, it's not that bad running a marathon after riding a bike," and I didn't believe them for a lot of years, but yeah, it's not much worse.
Yeah.
So when you talk to people, and I know I read I think it was in one of your books you were talking to people on the air. I think it was one of the books you were talking to people on. You know, every place you go, you have a copy of one of your books, and you can't help yourself but, you know, just try to chime into a conversation and, you know, and tell people. You know, at 48, you know, they probably thought you were crazy for not having traditional therapy. And then, you know, okay, so now you're in your 50s and you're running marathons and Ironman and you're doing well. So people have to start believing you a little bit. Is it easier for you to get the message across now, or?
There's a little more support, thankfully, because of documentaries like Forks Over Knives, and T. Colin Campbell's book, The China Study, has really helped. As I've traveled, and occasionally someone will come up to me and say, "Hey, I'm vegetarian." You know, then we get into conversations about, "You don't do dairy, do you?" Anyway, I'll ask them, "Well, what did it for you? I want to know what that magic key is, what works for so many people that I haven't found yet." I still don't have my family converted, which is really a source of despair. You know, how do I tell my kids, "Hey, kids, you know, look at your mom." Well, mom's crazy, but and the grandkids. But I asked them, "Well, what did it for you?" And so many of them have said, "I read T. Colin Campbell's The China Study." I thought, wow, that's a powerful book. You know, I worried about that because people might read that and say, "Well, that's Chinese, and I'm American, so it's different," not realizing that it applies just as well. And especially here in Hawaii, where we have such a mixed population, we have so many Asians, and what we know is that if they come from China, Japan, Vietnam, Thailand, and they change their diet when they get here, they very soon get the same diseases that we get here. So it's not genetics, as so many people want to believe.
I did watch the NBC coverage of Kona this year, and, of course, the mayor of Kona raced, and he was the last guy to cross the finish line. And I guess the only, you know, I mean, I they comped him a spot, you know, because he's the mayor of Kona. But he was, you know, markedly overweight, and I could only think, you know, it's like, well, okay, yes, he did it, and, you know, okay, it says something that, you know, the struggles, and of course, the, you know, the NBC coverage, you know, the stories, you know, inspire a lot of people, that he's a regular guy, but boy, I'd like to see him come back fit and do it, you know. I think so much, and I think it's even gotten worse with, you know, the big marathons now and the rock and roll series and the different series, where I think it's fantastic that people are getting off the couch and doing marathons. But I think, you know, when you cross the finish line and there's the cheese pizza and the donuts and people say they can eat whatever they want because they run, I think it, you know, it gives, again, it gives it a bad name because it's like, oh, you know, people die doing marathons. People get arrhythmias doing marathons. It's like, well, look what they eat, you know. So I do think I wish that more of the food, that the you know, the nutrition would come to play. And I think it is, you know, with some of the books, you know, that are coming out with some of the plant-based ultra runners and Rich Roll. I don't know if you've read his book and different things.
Oh, I've met him.
Yeah, and so So I think that that's probably, you know, more people are going plant-based, but there's certainly a, you know, a lot to do, because I do think that people think that, you know, just because you can complete an event like that doesn't necessarily mean you're healthy. It's like you said in your book.
Well, I remember Jim Fix, the Complete Book of Running author, and was totally sold on running as an exercise, and then, of course, had a massive heart attack and died while running, and the autopsy showed his coronary arteries were all blocked, one of them 99% blocked. And yet most people thought it was that running was bad for you, not that the diet had anything to do with it.
Yeah, so. I still have the occasional patient that will bring Jim Fix up to me.
Yeah, you know,
it's like, yeah, I know. Better to stay on the couch than to, you know, chance it.
Yeah. Well, that's why the editor of Lantern Books asked me to write Lifelong Running, because he, too, as a runner, hears all these myths. And then he says, well, I know somebody who's been running 45 years, and she's healthy. So that's the genesis of lifelong running. He called me one day and said, "We need you to write another book."
Yeah, I heard him interviewed as well. I guess he's a real advocate for animals and Lantern. The publishing company is basically based on animal advocacy and a real grounded basis. How is the ethics of being plant-based come to play with you? And, in Hawaii, you have...
More so. I started for health reasons, obviously, to save my life. And then once I got into it, my mindset changed. What I saw changed, besides getting this renewal of my life and seeing colors as if for the first time and this renewed appreciation for life. It spread to all of not just humanity, but animals as well. It was like all of a sudden I'd look into the eyes of an animal and think, that's like a person in there. They've got eyes. They're looking at me. They may not be thinking their thoughts in English, but they certainly have thoughts. Let me tell you, I'll try to make it short. I was doing a run almost a year ago, December 6th last year, and a typical run, and all of a sudden a dog came charging out of the yard and bit me, the back of the calf. I was so shocked. I'm screaming and yelling at this dog, and then the owner comes running out, and she's shocked too, and she's like, "Oh my God, oh my God," and she's yelling for her husband, "Bob, come here quick, our dog bit this lady, and it's bad." And they take me inside the porch and get bandages, and they're really so solicitous and worried, and the dog... all of a sudden, it came up slowly on his paws in this most submissive position, and his head, and I could read his eyes. He was so sorry. It was just, that animal connection. He knew he'd screwed up badly and was apologizing. And I thought, wow. It just gave me a whole new appreciation for what goes on in the minds of animals. And here, look at the way we treat them, not our dogs and cats, but all the other animals on this planet. We just know appreciation for their feelings, for their treatment, for what we do to them. So, yes, it made a big difference. And in terms of what we're doing to our environment, the mountains of manure from the factory farms and the cutting down of the rainforest. I mean, it just totally changed my life and everything I think about it.
Now,
I don't know how we get this to more people.
Yeah, I don't know either. That was going to, I'm going to pick your brain a little bit on that. I had getting ready for this talk, I've been taking some notes. And of course, I'm seeing patients in between. And I had a patient, a husband and wife, come in, and they both had coronary artery disease. They both had chronic lung disease, and they were getting ready to their son, who was 54, had bad lung disease, and she was going home to make him beef stew because that's what he liked, And it's just so difficult, People tend to show their love through food, and there's this connection with, well, it can't, if I grow up with it, it can't be wrong. And it's so hard for people to get that connection that, it's the food. And why are you, attacking what I've eaten all my life?
Yeah. And if my mother did it, it must be right. And if I learned it in school. Well, even schools of nutrition are still teaching that meat and dairy, meat for the protein and dairy for the calcium. Still, the University of Hawaii, the nutrition department, still teaching this, and it's probably mostly because the dairy industry and the meat provide the teaching materials to the schools, and the students, when they're learning how to be a registered dietitian, this is what they're taught, so they in turn teach others, and we've got to break into that cycle. I just don't know how to do it because we don't have the money behind us that they do.
I think, your book, your second, let's see, which one was it that I was reading this afternoon? It was Senior Fitness. You went through, it was really good, the sections that you went through as far as cancer. And, you know, people come into my office and it's like, well, do you eat meat? No, I hardly eat any meat at all. I eat chicken. That's really meat. And then, of course, then I eat a lot of fish. And it's like, well, you mean that's not good? And it's like, well, no, that's not good. And it's amazing. You know, I really think that we're seeing more dementia because of the increased fish consumption.
Yeah.
Because it's so tainted. But I liked that the study that you noted in the Journal of Nutrition, you know, the more fish that women ate, even a quarter of a serving was associated with increased risk of breast cancer. And you never see that.
No. And that study's been out a while. But, of course, nobody wants to hear it. They think fish is healthy and you need it for the protein. T. Colin Campbell was here in Hawaii. He was our monthly speaker for the Vegetarian Society of Hawaii. He gave a fantastic talk. In fact, we had standing room only. Almost 500 people attended our little monthly meeting. And he focused on the protein and did so much to dispel this idea that we need a lot of protein. In fact, it's the cause of so many of our problems, whether it's from fish or lean protein or whatever. And I'm hoping that more people realize that protein is not the answer. It's carbohydrates. And then, of course, you hear people talking about, I want to go on a low-carb diet, you know, as if carbohydrates are the villains. And I try to explain, well, our brains run on glucose. What do you think glucose is? It's a carbohydrate, you know. But there's so much misinformation.
Yeah, I think we've associated sugar as being a carbohydrate.
Yeah.
And so sugar causes problems. Therefore, anything that breaks down to sugar, you know, is assumed to be just as bad as the white sugar villain. And, I spend most of my day talking about that. And, of course, I've come to a point where I ask people, it's like, well, what exactly is a protein? And, you know, most people don't really know. There's not a lot of people that, you know, biochemistry is not a prerequisite in most degrees. And so they really don't know. And when you start talking about it, all of a sudden the kind of light bulb goes on a little bit. It's just this thing that, you know, it's been marketed, that, you know, it's been marketed by the meat industry. It's been marketed by the dairy industry. And people are so afraid. It's like, have you ever seen anybody protein deficient? Have you ever seen a doctor that treats protein deficiency? It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I also, the other thing that you brought up that I thought was, I had never seen actually and even thought about until today, was when you're looking at staging breast cancer. And of course, people, you know, there's a book, The Cancer, something about the all malignities, but looks at the cancer, you know, the evolution of breast cancer surgery and the treatment of breast cancer over time. And of course, how we used to maim women, you know, and take as much as you can. And the reality of it is, you know, like you mentioned, the horse is out of the barn, but this medial lymph nodes, you know, that makes so much sense. You know, we do this axillary dissection that causes, you know, a lot of problems in women. And the reality of it is, like you say, it doesn't catch at all. It doesn't help stage it, really. And the medial lymph nodes are never touched because it's not, you know, it's not easy to get to.
You can't reach them. Yeah.
So, it's just so, everything is just so twisted. If we could, you know, do just a little bit more prevention than the early diagnosis, I think is very frustrating.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's Angelina Jolie with her preventive mastectomies. With the genes, people don't know enough about the emerging field of epigenetics, that we may have the genes, but if we don't set the situation so they get turned on, it doesn't matter that you have the gene. It'll never be expressed. And the same with diabetes and heart disease. Yeah, we've all got those genes. But with the right diet, they're dormant. They don't get turned on. So I think the preventive mastectomies are really misguided, that women shouldn't have the surgery, that they should just change their diet.
The other thing is, you know, being lean, I think it's very accepted in the United States, especially, that as you get older, you get wider, and this, you know, you can visibly see it, especially in women, you know, 45 to 55, the spread. And it, of course, in guys, it's the beer belly is very much accepted. And people, you know, it's like, well, I look like the other guy sitting next to me at the Cracker Barrel. So it's not that big a deal. But, you know, how we forget that, you know, poor old Jack LaLanne, you know, he was spot on then, you know, way back when, you know, pinch, you know, I often bring back, you know, pinch an inch, my goodness, you know, most of my, you know, it's more than an inch, you know, we're talking, you know, handfuls here. I had a patient today has, you know, overweight and was telling me about, you know, his sleep apnea and his new mask and, you know, how fantastic it is. It's quiet and he sleeps well and everybody sleeps well and he doesn't snore anymore. And he said, you know, he said, younger people are getting it too now. And he just, it was almost like it's the flu or, you know, some contagious disease. And I said, you know why, right? And he looked at me and didn't have a clue. And I said, it's because of the obesity in the, you know, the United States. I mean, sleep apnea and treatment of it and the mask is becoming a huge business because of the obesity.
Yeah. And I think as long as you're eating animal foods, you're getting all those hormones. And they say, oh, no, but I only eat grass-fed beef or humanely raised chickens. What they don't realize is these animals are all either male or female. And regardless of their gender, they still all have those hormones. And you're getting those when you eat those animals. And those hormones, especially the IGF-1, is going to cause increased obesity. It does to you what it does to the baby calf, make you 600 pounds in 6 months, and it turns on all cell growth, which includes the mutations, spontaneous mutations for cancer. And that's why these diseases are so rampant, and obesity, I think, is going to continue as long as people keep eating animals. And you think what they, how much they ate in the early 1900s, very little because it was so expensive. Plus, it wasn't something that people normally ate anyway.
No, I liked, you know, your reference to the study and that, you know, post World War One when there the, you know, the scarcity and the rationing of dairy and the rationing of meat and they were never so healthy.
Yeah, the heart attack rates dropped, and everybody started being healthier. And then, of course, after the war ends, this happened in Hawaii as well. I was here during World War II when everything was rationed and everybody was supposed to grow victory gardens to get enough food. Same thing, you know, they got healthier. But as soon as the war ended and the shipping resumed, then they went back to eating meat and butter. Butter was a big thing, you know, when it was rationed, like, oh my God, I'm missing my butter. And then, of course, they came up with margarine, which is pure trans fat. That was even worse. So that's why I like the emphasis on low fat. It's true there are healthy fats, good fats, but we really don't need a lot of them. And I think since all plants have some fats, even onion, I remember in one of my classes I did the onion test. You take lens paper and rub it on onion, and there's some water and oil. And after a while, the water evaporates, but the oil remains. And that was a real graphic lesson to me that even onions have good fats. Carrots and corn, of course, all plants have carbohydrates, protein, and fat. And I think if you get a good mix of all the different plants, the vegetables and the fruits and legumes, that you're going to get the right mix of the nutrients your body needs, the macronutrients. Again, the carbohydrate, protein, and fat. It's pretty simple, but I guess it took me a few years to figure that out, too. I've been vegan now for, what, almost 33 years.
And you're mainly raw, right?
Yeah, but it's not that I think it's necessarily the healthiest way to go. It's that once I discovered triathlons and how much fun it was to run, bike, and swim, and I lift weights three times a week too, that I didn't want to spend time in the kitchen, that I realized food is fuel, and I want it the simplest, quickest way. That's why my cookbook is entitled Chef. It's an acronym, cheap, healthy, easy, and fast. And so, you know, the quickest thing is raw. You know, I go to the farmer's market, load up on the leafy greens and all whatever's in season primarily, come home, wash them up and cut them up and eat them up, and then I'm off and running again. That's what I discovered about raw. It's just easier and faster.
What about,
and cheaper.
What about your so-called, I have patients that, you know, are very reluctant to change because, well, I've heard that, you know, well, none of my friends will want to eat dinner with me. I can't, you know, have any fun. They won't ask us over for a party. You know, it's almost like that little high school thing, you know, if I don't do it like everybody else. And I'll get to the point where it's like, well, are your friends healthy? Well, no. And it's like, well, maybe you could actually be helping them if you, you know, were to eat right instead of, but, you know, what do you feel about, you know, what's your response to that when, you know, people are, you know, I'm not going to be able to eat with anybody and nope, you know, how do you, is your social circle mainly people that are plant-based or not really?
Well, I've had lunch with two girlfriends who are not vegan and, I'm trying not to push too hard, and one of them's a nurse. In fact, she's a nurse practitioner, and she's got health problems. So I took her out to lunch, and it just happened to be a vegan restaurant. And she looked at the menu, and I said, you aren't going to have any trouble finding anything to eat. She said, oh, no, this looks good, that looks good, and whatever. And she ended up having a dessert that was, can't remember what it was. Anyway, it had chocolate. Yeah. Anything with chocolate's got to be good, right?
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't have dairy. It's, you know, one of my favorite drinks is cocoa tea, where I have the 100% cocoa powder sweetened with stevia, which is an herb, so it's pretty healthy, and then green tea, which makes it even healthier. But the social aspects can be a challenge. I found out that no matter where I go, I went to a mini med school. We had a graduation. The University of Hawaii runs a mini med school, by the way. That's a lot of fun, too. Anyway, the graduation was a banquet, and I thought maybe I ought to tell them ahead of time. And then I thought, no, they're going to have enough variety. They're going to have some vegetables, and I'll just fill up on the vegetables. Well, sure enough, they had a great selection of not only the different veggies and a mixed organic green salad. So I loaded up on the greens and the tomatoes, and then they had a good supply of mixed raw vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower and carrots. And then they had brown rice with quinoa, and then they had the Okinawan purple potatoes. And I hadn't even gotten to the meat, and my plate was piled high. And, you know, and a few people looked at me, and so that was my excuse to say, look at all this delicious food, and there's no cholesterol. It's all zero cholesterol and really healthy. And then for decoration, because it was around Thanksgiving, they had pumpkins as a centerpiece. And so they announced that everyone take a pumpkin home. And most people didn't want their pumpkins, so I took three of them. I had pumpkin stew. I did cook it. I have a slow cooker, and I washed it, cut it up, and then just popped it in the slow cooker and added some onion and let's see what else. Oh, curry powder. And it was so good, and I thought, wow, you know, this is fantastic, but in terms of going out to eat, you can always find some vegetables, some whole grains normally, and then try to get fruit for dessert. Ann Dinshaw was our speaker here, the daughter of Jay Dinshaw, the founder of the American Vegan Society. And what she likes to do with other people is invite them to dinner and say, what are your three favorite vegetables? And everybody can name something. And she comes up with a dish. She makes it up based on their three favorite vegetables. And she says she always has them happy. I thought, that's a great idea for social introduction to good food.
Yeah, I usually try to, that's a very good idea. I usually try to ask people what their favorite meal is and then try to veganize it for them and say, okay, you can do it this way. My mom's been great. My mom's an Italian, and she's been, you know, had a ball with, you know, changing the recipes, you know, into completely plant-based, low oil. And, you know, and we basically do the same Christmas that we always do, just now plant-based. And, you know, the first year we did it, she said, you know, we usually have a pretty good party on Christmas Eve and people come over, and she said, nobody will ever come back. And it's like, you know, and she was real surprised. And of course, now this year, you know, she's adding to the different dishes. And as we eat something, she's like, well, that would be pretty. And this is a good salad. And we should do this and we should add this. And so it's been, you know, it's, I think it's fun. I think it, part of the problem, I mean, you know, you make a very good point. If you don't want to be in the kitchen, then eat simple. But I think it's also important maybe to get the younger people back in the kitchen, and to actually, you know, make their food and see where it comes from and, you know, take control of your nutrition. I often ask people, it's like, you know, you're very particular where you take your car for service, but you'll let some stranger in the back of a Denny's feed your body.
And yeah. Yeah,
it's you know, it's like that's much more scary. It's like, you know, these people aren't looking out for you. You know, I mean, it's just not, you know, in your best interest. But it's you know, it is a bit of a challenge. We are doing wellness classes in the office now, you know, having patients come in and bring their spouses and every other Wednesday and kind of compare some menus, and they're starting to enjoy it, and actually more and more people are signing up, so I'm hoping that really takes off, because I think that just that, I don't think, you know, you need cooking classes per se. It's just about, you know, menu planning. What do you substitute in, and getting enough food? You know, you talk about your plate being piled high. The one thing that I, you know, usually is my regret when I go out is people think you're vegan, so you don't eat very much. And because it's not calorically dense, you know, it can be, you know, arranged very pretty, and there could be like, you know, 100 calories on the plate. And like you, you know, I've worked out that day. I'm ready for a big pile of food. And it's like, so I think,
you do get to eat a lot, you know, with, as you, I'm glad you pointed it out, low caloric density. You have to eat a ton to gain weight or to keep from losing. You know, it's so much fun to be able to eat as much as I want and not have to worry about gaining. In fact, I worry more about losing because I have to eat a lot. But going back to your point about teaching kids, and I mentioned Ann Dinshaw, who was just here. She's got a book out that was published with her mother. The title is Apples, Bean Dip, and Carrot Cake, ABC, and it's for little kids. And I think from the age of 3 on up to teens. And it's full of beautiful pictures, and it starts very basic. You wash your hands, and these are the instruments you use, and this is a knife. And you know, it starts out with little kids. That's when you want to teach them how to prepare food and make it healthy and delicious and fun with their favorite foods. So it's a book I'd recommend for parents to get to. In fact, I did a review of it, and I said, I sure wished I'd had this when I was a kid, or even more, when my kids were kids, so I could have taught them right on how to prepare delicious food. It's fun.
Sounds like a good book to get for my office.
Yeah, Apples, Bean Dip, and Carrot Cake.
Okay. It's now on the list.
Good.
So when you're doing your races, how do you fuel?
It depends. Normally, that's not been a problem because I like to race lean and empty. I can't I never eat before a race. I'm either nervous or just not hungry. And I think your liver can store more glucose when you train this way. So it's never really been a problem. For long bike rides with a waste pack, I have bananas and rice cakes and dried fruit. I stay away from the processed stuff, you know, the goos and the power bars sort of things. Although I do have a recipe for millet bars in my cookbook. I just mostly fuel up afterwards. Mm-hmm. If there are bananas on the course, that's great. Yeah, I'm just trying to think what happens during an Ironman. I know in Kona, towards the end, I guess about the 20-mile mark on the marathon, they have chicken soup in it. I passed that aid station and went, ooh, yeah, God, who would want to have that? But mostly fruit. I think that's our best fuel. One thing I think I'm a contrarian on is on the glycemic index. You know, it's like if it's got a high glycemic index, bring it on, because when I'm running, you know, I want it to get into the bloodstream fast, right?
Yeah,
and that's with fruit, that's what you get.
I think that our, you know, the fruitarians have, you know, gone a long way to prove a point that, you know, if you live on, they don't have diabetes and they're very lean. So it's certainly not the fruit that's causing the problem.
Exactly.
I'll have patients, you know, I argue this, you know, because they just hear contrary. I fight, you know, the whatever's out, you know, I'm opposite of what's out there for the most part. And I'll say, well, mm-hmm. do me a favor, you know, have your crackers tonight in the morning, check your sugar. And then the next night, have a piece of fruit, and then the next morning, check your sugar. And I'll bet you that your sugar is going to be higher the morning after the crackers than the fruit.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually, you know, that is like, you know, I didn't, because, you know, people tell me they don't eat anything, but then it comes down to people try to eat crackers instead of bread because they think they're smaller and they're crunchy, so they're not as bad for you. And say, well, they're full of fat. And that's really what drives your sugar. But
yeah, there really should be a different term. I think the word sugar is so confusing to people because of the different meanings it has.
Yeah,
that white refined stuff should have a different word, and we should use glucose more when we mean blood sugar.
Yeah, I agree. I know, you know, growing up, both my grandmothers had diabetes from a very young age, and
wow.
You know, at the time, they were told, don't eat sugar. And so my grandmother, both of them were fantastic cooks. One was Irish, one was Italian. But they just didn't eat sugar things. They didn't eat the pies or the one, you know, but she ate everything else, you know, of course, cooked the one rich Irish, you know, high fat, lard, everything else, which was, you know, much worse probably than, you know, the other stuff. Of course, you know, we had a pie. You know, always the tease in some of my talks that if there was fruit, it's like, oh, don't eat that. Save it for the pie.
Mm.
You know, so we never ate. Growing up, I never ate fruit. Just eat fruit. And we had it in a pie. And, you know, with the lard and the sugar on top of it. So it's like, oh, my God.
And I always emphasize the whole food, the whole fruit. Don't juice it, for goodness sake. A lot of people do smoothies, which I think is you're depriving your teeth, gums, and jawbones of exercise. I always say they need to be exercised too. I was so shocked to find out that teeth are attached to their gums via tiny ligaments. And when you chew, you are exercising that whole mechanism, that whole system that starts the digestive process. It starts the salivation and the enzymes that start digesting food right from the mouth, and chewing as a very definite function, and it's beneficial. So people don't juice, and especially those that throw away the fiber. Oh, I think, oh, that's a crime. They should be arrested.
Yeah, it's amazing the marketing, you know, it's like going to be that, you know, people grab onto, and It's crazy. Just to change a little bit, did you meet Louis Zamperini?
No, never did. Never did. I know who he is, and of course he went through.
Yeah, the Olympic athlete, and then I thought, reading some of these stories, you know, he outlived all of his family. And, you know, he lived well until he just died this recently, but he was in his late 90s, I believe.
Yeah, 97,
you know, and of course, he was starved, you know, floating around in a lifeboat for 140 days and then a Japanese prison camp. And, you know, then he was also a runner. And, you know, there is some, you know, evidence for, you know, low-calorie eating, but I often think that, you know, his system was probably reset, you know? I mean, you know, even though he suffered, and you know, I'm not certainly not encouraging malnutrition as a means to an end, but you know, compared to his family who lived the standard American diet that all got sick and had problems, you know, by the time he came back, he was so much ahead of the game as far as his, you know, the way he hadn't accumulated, like, you know, the studies where the Korean, you know, the soldiers have the plaque in their arteries, you know, I mean, he basically underwent, cardiovascular disease reversal probably before he ever got started. And I always find that interesting, you know, especially, you know, as the kid's younger and younger, it seems to be, you know, more and more of a problem.
Yep. Starting with toddlers. Or probably in utero, actually, you know, because the way mothers eat when they're pregnant is not the healthiest either.
So do you have any suggestions for, you know, people getting along in a mixed household, you know, as far as their what they eat? Other than divorce their husband, get a divorce.
Yeah. Oh, it's a challenge. I do know that if you want to do a lot of fancy gourmet cooking, you can come up with some fantastic, fabulous tasting food. We have a new restaurant here. Well, it's not new. I think it's 2 years old now. It's a raw food gourmet restaurant. It's only 3 blocks from where I live. And it's all raw, it's all vegan, and the food is just delicious. And that would be a good place to take somebody, or if you wanted to make similar kinds of foods. Using fruit, you can sweeten anything. Most meat dishes are flavored by spices and herbs. The pure meat itself tastes like cardboard. Nobody eats straight hamburger or straight chicken. They always marinate it or at the minimum, lots of salt, pepper, and other spices to make it taste good. So you can use those same flavorings on tofu or anything, and it'll taste good. And sometimes you have to be kind of a sneaky cook. I know I talk about in my chef cookbook to get kids to eat broccoli. You tell them these are little trees, and you can cut them up and mix them in different dishes, and it tastes great. You just have to be creative sometimes and just get rid of the old ideas that you were raised with and think, why not? Oh, I remember I worked on the 1988 Seoul Olympics. I was so lucky to be invited to travel there and see what the athletes eat. Ate in the same place all the athletes ate. And it was like a great big circus tent with each station being a different country. So that if you're Japanese, you could go to the Japanese section and eat what you were used to. And the same with Russians and Chinese and African and American, of course, with their McDonald's. And so when I first got there, that was the first thing I did, was walk around to see what these other countries were serving their athletes. And back this 1988, and it just shook up my ideas of what you have to have for breakfast. You know, even though it was ham and eggs or bacon and scrambled eggs in the American section, the Japanese were eating miso soup and rice and veggies. And in Africa, I can't remember exactly what they were serving, but these were vegetables for breakfast. And it was such an alien idea, and I thought, why not? And that was when I started adding kale to the oatmeal that I was eating then, way before I went raw. And I cut up the kale, mixed it in with my oatmeal, cinnamon, and raisins. No sugar, no cream, no anything else, just those ingredients, and found out that, by golly, this is delicious. And I'm getting my leafy greens first thing in the morning, which is when you should get the nutrients going, especially if you're going to be working out. I really am a proponent for leafy greens. I think they're the healthiest food, one of the healthiest foods you can eat.
Fantastic. Yeah, I wish, I know that there was a study that actually looked at the Olympic athletes in performance, and that a plant-based diet actually resulted in a great performance. But unfortunately, it never really got much publicity because of, the dairy industry and all the different, sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
But, I wish, this chocolate milk campaign and some of this other stuff, it kind of drives me insane because, you know darn well that these guys aren't drinking this stuff right afterwards or they'd be doubled over.
I'm just reminded of Michael Greger. Are you familiar with
yes,
him?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. NutritionFacts.org.
NutritionFacts.org. Yes. It's fantastic. Every morning he comes up with something. I think, I got to save that, or I got to send this on to somebody. And it really is great. I think he's doing great things. And when his new book comes out, I'm going to be sure to get it. And I think he's probably got wide distribution. And Dr. McDougall's, drmcdougall.com is a great website, too. He has these little 2-minute lectures on constipation or depression or osteoporosis. A couple of days ago, diverticulosis, all these diseases that are caused by not eating the right foods and not getting enough exercise.
Yeah, I like his comment. He's basically said, it's the food, it's the food.
Yeah.
I feel his frustration. I try different approaches in my office and, good cop, bad cop, so to speak. And I guess I have, more of his personality, and I see his frustration. It's like, yes, I know. I can't.
Yeah.
But, well, I really, it's been a pleasure and honor to speak with you. I hope maybe someday I'll get to Kona and get to race and talk to you again about how the race went. And,
but that would be fun.
But, thank you for all you're doing. And, your books are wonderful. I'm going to have them available in my office.
You.
And
thank you.
I hope to get to speak to you again someday.
Well, I'm really thrilled at what you're doing. There are not very many cardiologists with the background you have, and you're able to help so many people, because heart disease is the number one killer, and you can get your cholesterol down without drugs, no statins, just change your diet. I went from 236 down to 160 in less than 21 days, and then down to 129, and no drugs, and I didn't even know this was just fighting breast cancer. So there's so many different benefits that if people only knew, they'd say, why didn't somebody tell me this a long time ago? We're trying.
Yes, I'm very excited and very passionate about it. So I hope to spread the word as much as I possibly can.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening, too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Heidrich. She is one dynamic lady. That's going to about wrap it up for today. Again, if you have any questions, you can get a hold of me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com, and that's JamiDulaney. I hope you have a plant-strong holiday season.